Welcome back to Foul Play-by-Play, the show that covers the week's law-related sports headlines. We're into Glenn Big Baby Davis, who was arrested again. 2 months ago, he was arrested with 126 grams of cannabis and $92,000 in cash. This time, on Friday, last Friday, he was arrested for felony assault with intent to cause great bodily injury. According to TMZ, after almost hitting a man with his car, Davis allegedly slammed the man onto the concrete when confronted. Glenn Baby, go ahead.
That's a little worse than having a little weed on you there. I think Davis is going to go down for this one.
Yeah, well, you don't think he's going to go down for the 126 grams of cannabis and $92,000 in cash?
Well, yeah, but I mean, this is, to me, this is something that matters more than that.
Did you see
go ahead.
Did you see what he tweeted about that $92,000 in cash?
Uh-uh.
He said that they were jump shots. Whole lot of jump shots. Yeah.
I love him, but I think he needs to smoke a little of that weed and relax.
I think he's pretty relaxed. I mean, I wouldn't be too relaxed about an assault charge or felony cannabis and, you know, losing $92,000 in cash because, you know, it might have been raised improperly. Our final headline of the day involves the NFL because, of course, it involves the NFL. They dominate the headlines. League Commissioner Roger Goodell weighed in on the Supreme Court's recent decision that the Professional and Amateur Sports Protection Act of 1992 is unconstitutional, opening the door for states to legalize sports betting. Goodell wants Congress to create uniform betting standards that, at minimum, include substantial consumer protections, protection of the content and intellectual property of sports leagues, providing official, reliable league data, and resources necessary for law enforcement to protect fans and penalize bad actors here and abroad. It all makes sense. U.S. Senator Orrin Hatch, a Republican from Utah, has been speaking with the NFL and is planning to introduce federal sports betting legislation that would address these issues. Maybe, Mike, you could give us a more detailed vision of what that legislation looks like, how it would protect consumers and sports leagues and provide law enforcement with whatever resources they need.
Yeah, without knowing, you know, the specific details of whatnot, what they're actually going to throw in there other than what Goodell has said. Essentially, I think it is a good idea from Goodell. I mean, at least start with a federal level because, I mean, that last ruling is kind of leaving it up to the states. So at least if we can get this federal law done that kind of serves as a baseline, if you will, where there's going to be at least some protections to protect the consumer so that you don't have people stealing your money or affecting bets or what have you. And once you make that law, then you can make criminal penalties for it. So essentially, you'll force people to comply with it.
Right. But criminal penalties, wouldn't they be made at the state level, though?
Yes. Well, I mean, you'd create the base. It's tough to see because I'm moving my hands around like I would before. What the federal law is going to do is create a nice base. It's kind of like what the U.S. Constitution does for the state.
Right.
And so that's a bare minimum of what the states will have to comply with. A lot of states will make better, maybe more protective laws, but they'll have this base that they'll at least have to guide them. So I think it is the proper, they're going through the proper motions here, I guess.
Well, unlike Major League Baseball, the National Basketball Association, and the Professional Golfers Association, the NFL has not expressed an interest in receiving a direct cut of legalized sports betting action. Instead, sources say the league is more focused on monetizing data and video rights, and for good reason, I think. While MLB, the NBA, and PGA Tour are lobbying for what was 1% of all money wagered on their games, have since lowered their demands to 0.25% of all wagers. The NFL is laughing about that 0.25% because it amounts to Roger Goodell's pocket change. $1.7 billion was bet on both college and professional football at Nevada sportsbooks last year. Half of that is $850 million if you're considering the half that the NFL is most likely responsible for. And then 0.25% of that is only $2.125 million. The NFL doesn't get into bed with anyone for a couple million dollars, but there's billions of dollars to be made selling analytical information to gamblers, gambling on games that are decided by fewer and fewer points this year or each year. And I think that's the
exactly. No, I think you're right on the nose there, Tony.
So according to research by Eldorado, the 2015 NFL season had the lowest median margin of victory in history. Games nowadays are more than twice as likely to be decided by 3 points than games played from 1922 to 1973. Over at Marisoft.com, you'll find that almost 24% of all NFL games played in the last 20 years were decided by 3 or fewer points. Roughly half of all NFL games are won by underdogs. So the sport's a damn nightmare to bet on, and it frankly, I stay away from it almost completely unless I'm 100% sure of an outcome. So many elements go into determining the outcome of a football game. Officials, like we talked earlier, weather, whether somebody's healthy or not, which you really never know completely. So while MLB, NBA, and PGA Tour are negotiating it over what amounts to Roger Goodell's pocket change, the NFL is looking to exploit the vast amount of data its sport produces by owning the method or math it chooses to turn that data into information. And it can sell that to clueless gamblers as a subscription service or something. I think this was a big deal when the Supreme Court came to determining the legality of fantasy sports betting. Because fantasy sports gamblers who win most often aren't simply luckier than the losers. They employ an algorithm that considers all the things they feel affect the outcome of sporting events. The NFL, I think, aims to own the algorithms and sell the answers those algorithms provide. And while there's bound to be competition in that market, should the NFL even be allowed to participate in that market if we want to protect consumers, as Goodell said in his statement?
I mean, as an attorney, I should be making some anti-monopoly argument, but those have... we still have those laws in the books, but I mean, if you look at any private industry, I mean, it's, you look at our TV stations, our phone lines and everything, everything's monopolized now. So I don't,
right.
I mean, the NFL is going to be allowed to monopolize this market in the same fashion they've been monopolizing football for the last,
since
how many ever years.
Existed.
So.
Yeah, well, since the AFL became part of the NFL, I guess.
And I mean, I guess Trump tried that league for a while, but that didn't really...
XFL, yeah. Well, there's actually two new leagues that are going to be started.
Oh, I wasn't aware of that.
Yeah, McMahon is starting one, and then another guy is starting another league. I don't know what the rule differences would be, but... McMahon said in his press conference, the only rule that's currently on the books is that players would stand for the national anthem. That was literally that. Yeah, we don't know what the rules are yet, but damn it, players are going to stand for the national anthem. That was the most important thing.
Is that McMahon from pro wrestling?
Yeah.
Yeah. Hell yeah.
The guy who failed miserably with the XFL previously.
Yeah, but imagine Hacksaw Jim Duggan out there with a 2x4 and a flag waving.
Oh, I'm totally for it. I hope they take the kickers out of the game. I don't want any kickers. I want, teams going for it on fourth down.
Tony, quit talking about the actual game itself. I go to sporting events to watch the national anthem.
yeah, I wish they played it before movies. I would just tear up before a movie. And the, you know, there'd just be no reason to sit around in the theater and watch the movie if they played a good national anthem.
Yeah.
All right, well, let's cover a couple of other headlines that we touched on last week. We've been talking about Trump, so I figure we better say one thing that nice about the guy. He did pardon Jack Johnson, former heavyweight champion, who was found to be in violation of the Mann Act in 1913. The Mann Act was basically a law that prohibited black men from bringing white women across state lines. It was supposed to thwart sex trafficking, but it was really just there so cops could harass black men with white women in the car. What do you think about this? Should we give Trump a little thumbs up for that? A very small thumbs up since he canceled the Korean summit?
Yeah, well, I think for what Johnson meant for and what that law actually meant for African Americans, and I mean, essentially, the law was used so that black men couldn't be with white women. It was, I mean, one of those racist laws to protect the white race and the white women that needed to be protected because it's disgusting if a black man would lay with a white woman. So I think we've actually got to give Trump a big thumbs up on this one. Just because, I mean, that's part of our dark past, but on the flip side, he uses that dark past to kind of stir us up all the time anyway, so.
Well, it took Sylvester Stallone to convince Trump to pardon Jack Johnson, so maybe Stallone should get a thumbs up as well. Joining us now is Associate Professor of Business Law and Ethics at Indiana University, Nathaniel Groh. His research interests include the application of federal antitrust and labor law to the professional sports industry, along with the field of U.S. intellectual property law. He is the author of 16 law review articles, as well as the award-winning book Baseball on Trial, The Origin of Baseball's Antitrust Exemption. Today, however, we're discussing his chapter in the Oxford Handbook of American Sports Law on the enduring power of the Sports Broadcasting Act. Both books are available for sale on Amazon.com. Thanks for taking the time to inform us, Professor Groh.
Thanks for having me. Looking forward to it.
Could you summarize the Sports Broadcasting Act of 1961 and what it does to and or for our listeners?
Sure. So the Sports Broadcasting Act is in some ways really narrow and in some ways pretty important. And basically the idea is that Congress said in 1961 that it wanted to allow sports leagues to negotiate league-wide television contracts on behalf of their teams. And so the idea is that, you know, before 1961, leagues oftentimes let each of their own individual teams negotiate their own television deals, both
right.
regionally, as we still see, in some cases nationally. And this said that the league itself was clearly allowed to do so under antitrust law on a nationwide basis.
And what was the point of allowing leagues to negotiate those contracts rather than teams?
Sure. So basically, the immediate purpose of it was that a federal court in 1961 had said that the NFL's contract with, I believe, CBS was illegal under the Sherman Act, under the antitrust laws, that it was basically 16 or 8, I forget how many teams the NFL had at that point, you know, teams colluding together to negotiate illegally. And Congress said, no, we want to allow the NFL to do that. And the Congress's larger purpose was that it was worried about competitive balance. And the concern was that, say, in Major League Baseball, if the New York Yankees are allowed to negotiate their own national television deal, that they'll just, you know, roll over everybody else in the league financially, and that the leagues will become so disproportionate in terms of competitive balance that they'll eventually, you know, wither and die. And so Congress said, we want to be able to let the leagues do this league-wide, because then they can split all the television revenue evenly and help support smaller market franchises against those large market teams.
Now, was baseball's lack of a salary cap the biggest driving force behind this? Because most of the leagues are governed by a salary cap and even a minimum amount of money that has to be spent on payroll. Isn't that enough to preserve competitive parity?
Yeah, and I think that in some ways, yes, and in some ways, no. And so I think in 1961, I don't think that most leagues had quite the same, you know, rigid salary cap structure as they do today. The other, I mean, I think that on the whole, what you said is definitely right. There's still some on the margins. You might see it a little bit where, again, if and to use baseball as an example, if the Yankees had their own, you know, contract with ESPN, so that every game was televised nationally, even with a salary cap, you might still see players say, well, I'd rather be in New York because I'm going to get so much more publicity and so much more marketing attention that it'll, you know, I'll be able to supplement my income in other ways. So I think that, you know, the financial money of it was the immediate concern, but there are still, you know, on the margin, some other potential competitive balance concerns that may have played out as well.
So what might American sports leagues look like without the SBA?
I think in some ways they'd look the same, and in some ways they'd look totally different. And it's almost hard to imagine the world without the SBA if you're a sports fan. But, I mean, basically, if it hadn't been passed and that federal court decision had held up, then leagues would not be able to have their own nationwide television deals. And so to use the NFL, you know, there would be no NFL contract with Fox and ABC, or formerly ABC, you know, NBC for the Sunday night game and whatnot. CBS, you'd have each individual team signing its own television deal. And so the Cowboys would probably have a nationwide deal with some network.
Right.
And, you know, a few other major teams would. Other teams like Jacksonville would rarely have their own games televised. And the financial question would be, how would the leagues have adapted to that? Would leagues have said, okay, Cowboys, we're going to make you hand over all your television money so we can still distribute it and maintain some balance? Or would that not have played out? You've seen in MLB that, you know, the large market teams are really hesitant to do that if it's their own revenue stream. And
right.
so I think it's, you know, I think in some ways things would still be a lot the same. Games would be on TV. You probably have more games to watch. In some ways, it might be better for fans, but you might have had that competitive balance concern. The overall product might not be quite as entertaining as what we're used to today.
And teams in, say, Green Bay or Milwaukee would be competing over a very small population area in a geographic region with teams in Minneapolis. So I think the now that we have live streaming platforms and online television channels, what effect does the SBA have on those outlets?
That's a great question. And the interesting thing is that it has actually no direct effect. And so part of the way Congress wrote it, the law back in 61, was it said that it was exempting the league's sponsored telecasting packages, basically. And this idea of sponsored telecasting was totally advertising, subsidized, not non-subscription basis television. So like the traditional over-the-air, you could pick up for free with an antenna networks like NBC, ABC, and CBS. And so courts have said after the fact that it doesn't apply to league contracts with ESPN and TNT and whatnot. And, you know, we can get into the weeds a little bit on about why that is, but overall, the courts have said that this just applies to the over-the-air packages with the major networks, traditional networks.
He's Nathaniel Groh of Indiana University and author of Baseball on Trial, The Origin of Baseball's Antitrust Exemption. Nathaniel, what potential effects does the Supreme Court's decision to allow states to determine the legality of sports betting have on the SBA, if any?
So I think that it doesn't have a direct effect necessarily, but it'll have some kind of secondary effects. And I think, you know, one of the things that most people are anticipating coming out of the legalization of sports gambling is that it's actually going to increase interest in televised sporting events. That the studies have shown that fans are way more engaged in these league games if they're betting on them. And so I think what you're probably likely to see is the value of television packages potentially going up. And, you know, with the packaging of, you know, cord cutting and the unbundling of television, it's hard to say exactly how that's all going to play out, but this is definitely a factor that's going to benefit the leagues in that regard. And so I think that, you know, the value of these television deals that are subsidized or that are protected by the Sports Broadcasting Act are probably going to go up. And in that way, the leagues might benefit even more and rely even more on the protection they get from this, you know, relatively little known statute.
Well, as a professor of business law and ethics, what is your thought on the implementation of these statewide gambling on sports legislations and how it's going to play out?
Sure. I think that it's going to be interesting to see exactly what role Congress takes. Senator Orrin Hatch from Utah has kind of suggested that he wants to craft a new federal law to help navigate some of this area. Mm-hmm. I think the sports leagues have suggested that they prefer that approach because, you know, the danger, I guess, from the league's perspective is that if you've got 50 different states passing 50 different laws,
right,
it's going to be kind of all over the place. There's going to be kind of what we call sometimes a race to the bottom, that whichever state has the least, you know, regulation of it is going to kind of take control. And I think that the leagues would prefer to see at least some federal minimum, you know, rules put into place. And, you know, does Congress get around to doing something? Obviously, Congress hasn't done a lot lately in terms of legislation. Can the leagues get something passed there or not? And then at the state level, you know, just how I think the big question is kind of how widely states allow it. Some states like Indiana have talked about just allowing it at horse tracks and exist, you know, riverboat casinos. You know, a lot of fans probably aren't going to go out, drive 2 hours to get to one of those places, right? And so
right,
it might not actually have that big an effect at reducing the illegal gambling already going on. But the more, you know, states roll it out on a widespread basis, I think the more likely you are to see a major transformation of that industry.
Well, and I think Hatch has been in discussions with the NFL regarding minimum requirements for sports betting that they'd like to implement nationwide. I think the NFL, though, is not so interested in getting a percentage or a cut of all monies wagered on their games. I think they're more interested in the profits that are to be made from the information they could provide gamblers, since their game is at a point where the margin of victory is lower than it's ever been. There's, I think, more elements go into determining a football game than just about any other sport. But should the NFL be in the business of providing this information directly related to gambling on their respective game? I mean, or is there a conflict of interest there?
Yeah, that's a good question, too. You know, I think that there's kind of two ways to look at it. Obviously, the more money that's being bet on these games, the more of a risk there is for corruption and paying off a referee or whatnot. Mm-hmm. I think on the flip side, you know, some people have argued that if you, you know, there's already a lot of illegal gambling going on anyway, right? And if you legalize it, at least then it's more monitored and regulated. And, you know, casinos usually do a pretty good job of trying to detect strange betting patterns or, you know, detect something where something seems amiss, because they're going to lose a lot of money too if a game gets thrown. And I think in some ways it actually might help, you know, increase the integrity of the game if this is all taken above board rather than kind of in the dark. But, you know, I think reasonable minds could disagree or, you know, could differ either way on, you know, on the whether it's going to be good or bad for the league as a whole.
Well, that was very informative. Thank you very much, Professor Groh. He's Nathaniel Groh of Indiana University and the author of Baseball on Trial, The Origin of Baseball's Antitrust Exemption, available at Amazon.com. Thanks again.
Thanks for having me.
Well, that's our show, folks. Thanks for joining us here at Foul Play by Play. And tune in next week as Mike and I cover the week's cheats, cheap shots, and alleged criminals in sports.